Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Bonnie Milligan.
Oh, hey.
Oh, my gosh. I have to tell you all right now. You all know that I am obsessed with Bonnie Milligan in very many ways. I could go on and on about it, but we are so excited to have our very starry Broadway pal Bonnie here, whose Broadway career we adore. We love it. She's a true diva. She's a lady boss. She's a funny gal. We love her Broadway career immensely, and we are not going to talk about it at all.
Don't.
But in the same vein, who could possibly be more perfect for covering a killer clown?
Oh, God, terrifying.
I mean,
it's
Bonnie,
me.
Could
it's
you,
me.
You, giving, you guys you could are, be a killer clown in some iteration of some adaptation of a stage.
Yeah, if we gender bend this.
I,
no.
Come on.
We should. Well, yeah, more women, right?
That's right. You know what we're going to do, though? You guys, if you're game, when this episode airs, can we all do, like, face filters on Instagram of us as different kinds of clowns?
I was just going to actually paint myself as a clown.
I think we need to do that. Well, Bonnie, you were one of our first Broadway pals to share excitement when we launched our podcast, so we thank you for that.
Yes.
And so in that vein, we do want to know, A, why do you think we are all so into it? And B, what was your OG, hey, I think I'm into true crime story?
Why are we all into it? I feel like there's a part of us that it's like, if I ever get in this situation, I want all the information of what other people have gone through. So how am I going to react? Like, I watch scary movies very vocally. I'm like, no, do not do that. Why are you going upstairs? Madam, excuse me. Oh, no, she's making bad decisions. No, you're going to die. You are going to die.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you feel like you want to gather information for when it happens to me because I'm not a runner, you know, and so I don't think I'm going to outrun a killer. And so I think I have to outwit them because also just I think the mental anxiety of they're going to get me. I would just stop and be like, just please kill me already because I can't deal with this.
Oh, Bonnie, no.
Mm-hmm.
No,
Bonnie, it's no.
Mentally. But then that's why you have to like watch things to understand, to get yourself a game plan.
Right. So you're giving yourself you're giving yourself backup in a situation. You're giving yourself mental backup.
Mental backup.
Dot those I's, cross those T's. Right. You understand if somebody's going to come through the door, like maybe you have a knife in your bedroom.
Yes, you have to have a weapon ready.
Okay.
And if you hear something going, you have to look around you immediately and get a weapon.
See?
I've been saying that a lot to the TV and movie.
Yes, I told Jessica and our friend Kate Weatherhead, I would like to get all of my friends brass knuckles to sleep with.
Yes.
So that at least you have your fists, right?
Yes.
Something like that. Not necessarily that, but in that vein, right?
Yeah.
And go ahead, Jess.
I was just going to say I agree because, you know, I've been watching a lot of Amy Schumer lately, and one of the things that she does on her special is she... Is this me? Is that construction in my apartment building? So that's a fun...
No, that's right. Jessica does have construction down the hall. It's at the other end, I think. But listeners... We can't prevent that, but this is theater of the living. This is how we do it. Listen, we're just trying to get through this pandemic. We have been through with our guests every which way but loose how to record these things. We all should be in a room together, but that can't happen.
I'm sure you've
probably noticed, listeners, the difference in sound quality. We've had people out of the country in hotel rooms, no earphones, no microphones. We're doing our best to mix it. So thank you for your patience. So Bonnie, originally you were born in Illinois. Is that correct?
Yes, Decatur, Illinois. Central Illinois.
Well, and cheers to that. And it could not be a more appropriate moment for us to gather in our clown love and begin. And first, like, let us give our credit where credit is due. Once again, we have to give our props to Wikipedia. Snaps and claps to Wikipedia.
Oh, we love Wikipedia.
She's helpful. Ladies and gents, this is the story of John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy was born in Chicago on March 17, 1942, the second child and only son of John Stanley Gacy and Marion Elaine Robison. His father was an auto repair machinist and World War I veteran, and his mother was a homemaker. Now, Gacy was close to his mother and two sisters, but endured quite a difficult relationship with his father, an alcoholic who was physically abusive to his wife and children. His father also belittled him, calling him, quote, dumb and stupid, and comparing him unfavorably with his sisters. And one of Gacy's earliest memories was being beaten with a leather belt for accidentally disarranging car engine components his father had assembled. That seems to be a good reason. His mother tried to shield her son from the father's abuse, which only resulted in accusations that he was a sissy and a mama's boy who would, quote, probably grow up queer. Despite his mistreatment, Gacy still loved his father, but felt he was never good enough in his father's eyes. So in 1949, Gacy's father was informed his son and another boy had been caught sexually fondling a young girl. After that, his father whipped him with a razor strop as punishment. And the same year, a family friend and contractor would sometimes molest Gacy in his truck. Now, Gacy never told his father about this, afraid that his father would blame him. Gacy was an overweight and unathletic child because of a heart condition. He was told to avoid all sports at school. During the fourth grade, Gacy began to experience blackouts. He was hospitalized on occasion because of seizures, and Gacy later estimated that between the ages of 14 and 18, he spent almost a year in the hospital and attributed the decline of his grades to missing school. His father suspected these episodes were an effort to gain sympathy and attention and openly accused his son of faking his condition as Gacy would lay in a hospital bed. Although his mother, sisters, and a few close friends never doubted his illness, Gacy's medical condition was never conclusively diagnosed. And one of Gacy's friends at a high school recalled several instances when his father ridiculed or beat him without provocation. Once in 1957, he witnessed Gacy's father shouting at his son for no reason, then began hitting him. Gacy's mother attempted to intervene. The friend recalled that Gacy simply, quote, put up his hands to defend himself, adding that he never struck his father back during these altercations. This is not a good dad.
No.
The two of you said that in tandem. You were like, no.
No.
Well, we played mother and daughter once. I'd like to say I was the daughter, but no.
How was your relationship? Not like this one. It wasn't like this one.
She was not a kind mother. But she wasn't this, like this.
I wasn't. But she I mean, wasn't not like the this. Actress. Not the actress, Jennifer.
No, not
she
Jennifer.
She was kind.
The but kindest.
But the mother was just. She was
she had issues. Well. Uh-huh. But she was not abusive. She was not abusive.
No, not like
she was
this.
Just emotionally distant.
Okay. No. Okay. Well,
I mean, if this were Criminal Minds, they would be like, well, there's your trigger right there. There are so many triggers, right?
Oh, a lot of triggers. Beyond.
That's my favorite thing about the show, by the way. There's your trigger. That's your trigger right there. I mean,
well, there's the smoking gun.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, and in Chicago. I mean, but here's the thing. Like, fuck that dad. I'm just saying that right now. I'm putting it in the ether at this very moment. The dad.
Fair.
Ruined some shit for Gacy. So as we move forward, here's the thing. Gacy had so many jobs. He first tried to get involved in politics, another thing his dad hated.
Nervous.
Bonnie's nervous. And after yet another incident with his father, he then drove out to Las Vegas and he found work within the ambulance service before he was transferred to work as an attendant at a, wait for it, mortuary.
Oh, God.
So he worked at this mortuary for 3 months, observing morticians embalming dead bodies. And he later confessed, get ready for this, Bonnie. He later confessed that one evening while he was alone, he had decided to climb into a coffin of a deceased male, embracing and caressing the body.
No, before
Bonnie, I'm just reporting the facts. Bonnie, I'm reporting the facts.
Don't kill the messenger, Bonnie. God,
he
Bonnie.
Caressed the body. He caressed the body before experiencing shock from this incident. And
he experienced shock from what he was doing to a dead body?
Yes, Bonnie. And I don't listen. As you might be well aware of this, but I'm just going to throw it out there now because our listeners, our tried and true killers, already know this. We do consider ourselves experts in the field of which we are discussing, of whatever case we're discussing, okay?
For sure.
So, Bonnie, you are also now an expert of morticians. You're an expert of embalming.
Thank you.
So He has shocketh himself from this incident in a coffin with a dead person. Sounds normal, which this prompted him to call his mother the next day. Did he tell his mother about it? No. But he asked whether his father would allow him to return back home to Chicago, and his father said yes.
So, like, how old was he at this point?
He's in his 20s.
Okay.
He's in his 20s. But he's, you know, he's got many issues here with his dad.
Oh, clearly. So many.
So he's, you know, as an expert here, I would say, like, this guy is terribly afraid of his father.
But he's going to him when he experiences shock that he inflicted upon himself.
Exactly. So again, like, it's a healthy time. So he returns home, right? He decides to finish college. He gets a job. And he was working in Springfield, Illinois, where he met a coworker, Bonnie.
That's near from where I'm from.
Well, mm-hmm. Now our listeners, we don't have any of this videotaped. So I tell you that Bonnie really had a moment of shock that she mm-hmm. brought on herself. You see, Bonnie?
It was like she was in the coffin. It was like, whoa.
It's like, whoa. I climbed into the coffin.
She was. It was like, yeah. In Springfield, Illinois. I mean, it really, for everybody who loves theater, mm-hmm. God bless, she mm-hmm. really gave us a moment.
Now, my brother works in Springfield, Illinois. So there you go.
Well, we got to talk to him. Now, Gacy met a coworker at the time. Her name was Marilyn Myers, and they became engaged shortly after meeting. Marilyn didn't know. And after a six month courtship, they married in September of 1964. And Marilyn's father subsequently purchased. This is the most exciting part of this story. He purchased 3 KFC restaurants in Waterloo, Iowa. I mean, God bless.
Delish.
God bless. Yeah. The chicken, the journey. And the couple moved there so that he could manage the restaurants, with the understanding that they would move into Marilyn's parents' home, which they vacated for the couple. How nice of them.
It's mm-hmm. nice.
The offer itself was very lucrative. Gacy would receive $15,000 per year, which is the equivalent now of about $123,900. Plus, Bonnie, you have a train out there?
I sure do.
You guys, this is the best episode ever. Trains, saws, what are we building in our backyard? Now, let's get back to this. $123,900 per year, pretty hefty, plus a share of the restaurant's profits. Now, following the obligatory completion of a management course, Gacy relocated to Waterloo with his wife. And maybe many KFC managers wouldn't do this, but Gacy opened a club in his basement where his...
On his house or the yes, basement of KFC?
The basement of his house.
Okay.
Where he allowed his employees to drink alcohol and play pool. And although he employed teenagers of both sexes at his restaurants, he socialized only with...
Boys.
That's right, girl. You win the prize.
Ding, 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 ding.
Now, Gacy gave many of them alcohol before he made sexual advances. And if they rebuffed him, he would claim his advances were simply jokes.
So funny. Oh, it's so funny.
And Gacy's wife gave birth to their son in February of 1966, and then subsequently a daughter in March of 1967. Gacy himself later described this period of his life as, quote, perfect. He finally earned his father's approval, and when Gacy's parents visited in July of 1966, his father apologized for all of the abuse and said, quote, son, I was wrong about you.
Wowza. Wowza, you guys.
Yikes.
That makes up for it.
Yeah. Definitely. Oh, sorry. Oh, you did get married. I shouldn't have abused you.
He's making money
gay.
Now, Bonnie. Bonnie, what? He's making money.
But also, wasn't part of the abuse him saying you're queer? That was part of it, right? So then when he gets married and makes money, he's like, oh, never mind. Sorry about that. You're crazy.
Oh, he's not. He's not well. Not well.
You're crazy. Great. Okay.
Right. Well, truth be told, this story it's quite complex, as you've now realized. It's lengthy and it's complicated. So we're going to try to keep it as simple as possible. And you could probably guess, right, Bonnie, that shit is really starting to hit the fan now, right? It's about to go down, don't you think?
Yeah, he has an underground club. Like, this is, mm-hmm. sir, what's with the, I can't, yeah, the velvet rope, the underage. He's like Octavia Spencer in that movie, what, Ma? Yes. She's like drugging kids. Yeah. Doing stuff, trying to be popular. Oh
great. Boy.
Okay.
So Gacy was a very active participant in a group called the JCs for several years. This is a civic organization for young men to develop leadership and business skills. In Waterloo, Gacy joined the local
NXIVM. That sounds so weird, right?
Now having just done a couple of cult specials, this could be sort of in that vein. However, JC, you know, the JCs were, you know, mm-hmm. they were an Illinois thing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's everywhere. This was the local JC's chapter that he joined, regularly offering extended hours to the organization in addition to the 12 and 14 hour days he worked managing three KFCs. I didn't really remember that part of the story till I just read it, that he was like going in between three chicken. He was managing three of them. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the other JCs held him in high regard for his fundraising work and in 1967 named him outstanding vice president. The same year, Gacy served on the board of directors. Gacy and other Waterloo JCs were also deeply involved in wife swapping, prostitution, pornography, and drug use.
That sounds so fun, you guys.
Wait, was Marilyn on board for this? Was she being wife swapped, or did she? Or was he just getting other wives?
It's a very good question.
Know, but I would imagine. I don't know, man.
Okay. Great question. So,
thank you.
But I don't know. Here we go. So in August 1967, Gacy sexually assaulted 15-year-old Donald Voorhees, the son of a fellow JC. Gacy lured Voorhees to his house, having promised to show him pornographic films. Gacy plied Voorhees with alcohol and persuaded him to perform oral sex. Over the following months, Gacy similarly abused several other youths, including one whom Gacy encouraged to have sex with his own wife before blackmailing him into performing oral sex on him. So maybe she wasn't involved. That was just a lure. Is that what we think?
I'm feeling that it was a lure. I mean, I really thought about this.
Because otherwise that's her having sex with an underage kid.
And I thought about him being like, okay, you know what? I would love for you to sleep with my wife. And you can imagine the kid being like, I don't really feel comfortable with that. I don't feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And then you can imagine like the blackmail of it being like, well, I'm going to tell people that you slept with her unless you do this with me. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's where my mind went. As an expert, I'm just thinking that, but you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So Gacy tricked several of these teenagers into believing he was commissioned to conduct homosexual experiments in the interests of scientific research and paid them up to $50 each.
Was this around the time of Kinsey? Like, would that have been a thing?
No.
What would you be like, oh, yeah, I've heard of people doing that. Like, that feels like such a crazy idea.
Let me double check, but Kinsey was much earlier. That was much earlier.
But you could have heard about that. You're like, oh, this is a thing that's happened.
Let us just also say that he's a manipulator. Like, he's gotten some good manipulating skill, right?
Yeah.
Well,
he's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to say that. Jen, please keep us going because it
gets
crazier.
Okay, I'm going to keep you going. Okay. So, in March 1968, Voorhees reported to his father that Gacy had sexually assaulted him. Hold, please.
Thank you.
We should keep it in to all the sounds we have today. Jen's contribution, sneezing.
This is such a good day. Okay.
Okay. So Voorhees Sr. immediately informed the police, who arrested Gacy and subsequently charged him with performing oral sodomy and the attempted assault of 16-year-old Edward Lynch. Gacy vehemently denied the charges and demanded to take a polygraph. The results indicated Gacy was nervous when he denied any wrongdoing in relation to both young men. Gacy publicly denied any wrongdoing and insisted the charges against him were politically motivated. Voorhees Sr. had opposed Gacy's nomination for appointment as president of the Iowa JCs. Several fellow JCs found Gacy's story credible and was rallied to his support. However, on May 10th, 1968, Gacy was indicted on the sodomy charge.
Amen.
That's right. On November 7th, 1968, Gacy pleaded guilty to one count of sodomy in relation to Voorhees, but not guilty to the charges related to other youths. Gacy claimed Voorhees had offered himself to him and that he had acted out of curiosity. His story was not believed. Gacy was convicted of sodomy on December 3rd and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment to be served at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. The same day his wife filed for divorce, good on you, girl, he never saw his wife or children again.
Good on you, girl.
Yeah, right?
You'll never see our children. They won't even know you as their father.
Yeah,
goodbye.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
In prison, he quickly took on the title of model prisoner. He was first denied parole in early 1969. Mm-hmm. On Christmas Day, 1969, Gacy's father died from cirrhosis of the liver. When told the news, Gacy collapsed to the floor sobbing. His request for supervised compassionate leave to attend the funeral was denied. Gacy was granted parole with 12 months probation on June 18, 1970, after having served 18 months of his 10-year sentence.
What?
Mm-hmm.
I hate that. Yep. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. Conditions of his probation included that Gacy relocate to Chicago to live with his mother and that he must observe a 10 p.m. curfew. He told many of his friends that he would, quote, never go back to jail again, end quote. On February 12, 1971, Gacy was charged
Question.
With...
Question. Yes, sorry,
go ahead.
Sidebar.
Bonnie, please.
So this is in Iowa, but then they're ordering him off to Chicago, but like... How are they going to keep track of him?
And
like,
that's a wonderful question, Bonnie. That's a wonderful question you have there. And
because those are like completely different
jurisdictions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
I'm from other podcasts and true crime things I've listened to and heard about, even things within the same state, their department, their sheriff departments don't talk to each other.
That's right.
And killers and, you know, sexual predator. What's the word? Deviants. Sure. Have been able to commit many, many crimes just because two departments aren't talking to each other within the same state. And this is another state.
I think you'll see here why he was able to do as much as he was able to do. Jen, take it away.
Okay. All right. Continue. Sorry.
That's not at all. On February 12, 1971, Gacy was charged with sexually assaulting a teenage boy who claimed that he had lured him into his car at Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal and driven him to his home, where he had attempted to force the boy into sex. The court dismissed this complaint when the boy failed to appear. On June 22nd...
Because he's a child.
Yeah. Ugh. On June 22nd, Gacy was arrested and charged with aggravated sexual battery and reckless conduct. The arrest was in response to a complaint filed by a youth who claimed that Gacy had flashed a sheriff's badge, lured him into his car, and forced him to perform oral sex. These charges were dropped after the complainant attempted to blackmail Gacy. The Iowa Board of Parole did not learn of these incidents, and 8 months later, in October 1971, Gacy's parole ended.
Scooby-dooby-doo, Bonnie.
Mm-hmm. To your question.
Why does his... I don't understand. Like, if somebody was sentenced to a 10-year sentence...
Right.
And then you're like, okay, you can leave after a year and a half, but we'll put you on parole for like a year. Why wouldn't you just like have parole for the full amount of your sentence? Like, I'm sorry, you can't go commit any other crimes.
And also, I mean, I know we're in the early 70s here. Why not just assign someone to the case who, you know, is either based in Iowa or based in Chicago who knows exactly what's happening? Because therein, we see that nobody talked to anybody, and now his parole is up, and he's back to living life.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have it.
So, with financial help from his mom, Gacy bought a house in an area of Chicago. He was considered active in the community, where he hosted many summer parties.
Of course he was.
Uh-huh. Ah, yes. And this was the house where he later admitted to having committed all of his murders. In August 1971, he became engaged to Carol Hoff, a divorcee with two young daughters. They were married on July 1st, 1972. His fiance and stepdaughters moved into his home soon after the couple announced their engagement. Gacy's mother moved out of the house shortly before the wedding. That was good. By 1975, Gacy had told his wife that he was bisexual. After the couple had sex on Mother's Day that year, he would inform her this would be the, quote, last time that they would ever have sex. He began spending most evenings away from home, only to return in the early hours of the morning with the excuse he had been working late. His wife observed Gacy bring teenage boys into his garage and found gay porn and men's wallets and identification inside the house. When she confronted Gacy about who these items belonged to, he informed her angrily that it was none of her business. They divorced in 1976.
Now, I want you all to know Bonnie's face right now. Killers, Bonnie's face really was frozen in an emoji, which I would think of as confused. You know?
Yeah. Je suis confuse. Question, when were they married? And then when was that Mother's Day of like, this the last time, babe? Like, how long were they intimate before he's like, I can't do this anymore?
Well, they married in 72.
72.
And he told her 3 years later that they couldn't be intimate anymore.
I love that Jessica and I were like Hermione Granger, like, 72. He's born both of us at the same time.
Yeah. But like, you thinking they were married 3 years. And then on Mother's Day, as one would.
On Mother's Day.
You know, such
what
a day.
Hell?
to celebrate the mother of your two stepdaughters. Hey, girl, listen, I'm bisexual, which again is perfectly fine. But then when you're like, and by the way, we're never having sex again. And also, like, if you do go into the garage or see me bringing young boys in and then find their wallets and some identification in the house,
it's
like,
not
like
your
also like none your biz and TTYL.
Also, I would be worried about finding wallets. Like, why didn't that boy know his wallet is missing?
Yeah.
And then, of course, she was like, middle fingers up, I'm divorcing you in 76.
Yeah. Yeah. So four years.
These women knew to get out. Good Lord.
It was a 4-year romance. So through Gacy's membership in a local moose club, Gacy became aware.
These clubs.
I know, right? Seriously.
Oh, Gacy.
So this one's a moose club. And in this club, he became aware of a Jolly Joker clown club. I'm going to say, Bonnie,
absolutely not.
Well, for our purposes, you would be cast as the Jolly Joker, and just for today. And these members regularly performed at fundraising events and parades, in addition to voluntarily entertaining hospitalized children. In late 1975, Gacy joined and created his own clown characters, Pogo the Clown and Patches the Clown. Now, he described Pogo as a happy clown, whereas Patches was more a serious character. So I am casting Jessica as Pogo the Clown today, and I am Patches.
That makes sense. Yeah.
We all have our roles? Okay. All right. So he'd later tell people that becoming a clown would help him to, quote, regress into childhood, end quote. I need a break, Jessica. I need a break.
I want to give you a break. Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-Step, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song, Killing It.
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-Step has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers. Jen is hydrating. And I'm glad that we now know where the clown title, you know, because he's called the Killer Clown, where it comes from. Thank goodness he had sort of a couple of characters to choose from for himself. Now, Bonnie.
Yes.
Let's move on to the murders.
Okay. Why not? It's a good time.
Once we introduce clowns, let's discuss the murder. And then nobody after this will decide to watch It. Or It 2. Or whatever.
You know, when I was a kid, it was Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Okay, Bonnie.
That was somehow shown to me, which I have not watched since. But I feel like an older cousin was trying to be a jerk.
Did it fuck you up?
Yes. I saw that when I was like 5. And I'm assuming, I've been told it's like a B movie kind of comedy, kind of like Arachnophobia. Like, it's not really scary. It's kind of ridiculous.
But I was terrified.
Yes, because I was a child. And I loved cotton candy. And they spun you into cotton candy before they ate you?
No, we're not well.
I don't like them.
But now, just think about this, though. Gacy murdered at least 33 young men and boys, and buried 26 of them in his crawl space of his house.
Mm-hmm. What?
Now, he usually lured a lone victim to his house, although on approximately 3 occasions, Gacy had what he called, quote, doubles, which are 2 victims killed in the same evening. And several of the victims were lured with the promise of a job because, you know, he was a big man on campus wherever he, you know, was working. He had several jobs at the time. So he lured them with the promise of a job. He lured others with offers of drinks, drugs, money, sex. And the victims included people he knew and also random individuals lured from Chicago's Greyhound bus station, Bughouse Square, or simply off the streets. And some victims were grabbed by force. Others were conned into believing that Gacy, who often carried a sheriff's badge and had spotlights on the black Oldsmobile he drove, was a policeman. Okay? Now, inside Gacy's home, his usual modus operandi, which, thank you so much, I do speak many languages, so I needed to put that in there, was to ply a youth with drinks, drugs, or gain their trust, which seems fun. Now, Gacy would produce a pair of handcuffs to show a magic trick, sometimes as part of his clowning routine, like are we pogo, are we patches? He typically cuffed his own hands behind his back and then surreptitiously released himself with the key, which he'd hidden between his fingers, and then offered to show his intended victim how to release himself from the handcuffs. Now, with the victim manacled
and unable...
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank
you. And unable to free himself, Gacy then made a statement to the effect that, quote, the trick is you have to have the key.
Now, Gacy,
I know, it's so
gross. Also, these are children.
Gacy referred to this act of restraining his victim as the, quote, handcuff trick. Fun. Now, having restrained his victim, Gacy proceeds to rape and torture the captives. And after death, Gacy usually stored the victim's bodies under his bed for up to 24 hours before burying the victim in the crawl space of his home.
How did he start killing them? Like, what, I guess, what's the trigger? The trigger? What made him start murdering them? Because it used to be just sexual assault.
Well, it was sexual assault. And then his whole thing was he would rape and torture them and kill them. Like, that was his thing.
Gotcha.
Handcuff trick happened. Then he proceeded to rape and torture the captive. He would sit on their chest. He would burn them with cigars. He would make them imitate a horse. He would make that. It was violent. And so Gacy typically murdered his victims after all of this sort of sodomization and violation, which I'm guessing had a lot to do with childhood. If we can, like, you know, we might think that that's where it comes from, or issues that he had with his dad. But he would torture these men. And he would drag them into his bathroom, where he partially would drown them in the bathtub before repeatedly reviving them and then assaulting them again.
I know.
This shit ain't right. And he typically murdered them by placing a rope tourniquet around their neck before tightening it with a hammer handle, and referred to the act as the rope trick. So we've got a couple tricks here of his. And he said occasionally the victim had convulsed for an hour or two before dying.
Oh my gosh.
Most of them died by asphyxiation. I mean, it's all just absolutely awful. And after the death, we said this, he stored them under the bed, where he periodically poured quicklime, which hastens the decomposition of the victim. Now, again, here's where Mortuation Station comes in. He knew how to embalm.
Oh, right.
So he took the bodies to his garage sometimes and would embalm them prior to burying them. So
how do you just, like, buy embalming liquid, though? Like, you have to, like, there's, like, whole things where you suck things out of it. Like, how do
you... No, well, what you have to do is you have to... We've talked about this in other episodes. You need to go to a Meijer's. You have to find a Meijer's where you can get milk, a loaf of bread...
Some cookies.
And some embalming fluid. Some lime, yeah.
You know, when you do, there are several things, though. I mean, and again, like, this is not like everybody go to the store and try and figure this shit out for yourself. But
there are
ways for, like, the layman, right, who's not working at the mortuary anymore, to go and find items that will do the job that you can find at a hardware store, or you can find them at, you know, some weird ass place. But it does exist. Now, we get to a point here where several killings have already happened. Right. Nobody can tie them to Gacy at this point, but there's one disappearance that led to the investigation and arrest of Gacy, and that was the disappearance of a guy named Robert Peist. When this guy goes missing, his family files a report. His family's like, this doesn't make any sense.
How old was he?
He was in his teens.
Oh, of course. A boy.
No, a boy. They were convinced that he could not have run away from home, right? They're like, this doesn't make any sense. Now, a couple of people had said that Gacy had been named as a person that Peist was talking to about a job. So a routine check of Gacy's criminal background revealed that he had an outstanding battery charge against him in Chicago and had served a prison sentence in Iowa for the sodomy of the 15-year-old boy we discussed earlier. Now, police decided to question Gacy, to which he vehemently denied offering this young boy a job or seeing him at all this evening. But officers are like, red flag, red flag. We think you're not telling the truth. We think that you're holding him against his will at your home. We think this could be a thing. You were already convicted and sent to jail for sodomy of a 15-year-old. Who knows what else you could possibly have done? And they get a search warrant for his home. And that's where the first search warrant comes in for his home, because there's a suspicion that he could possibly be keeping this young boy against his will at his home after offering him, quote, a job. They go to his property. They see several suspicious items, which include police badges, pistols, a syringe, hypodermic needles in the bathroom, handcuffs, books on homosexuality, pornographic films, dildos, bottles of Valium. Like, several driver's licenses were found in his bedroom. Underwear, too small to fit him, was located in his bathroom closet. Yeah. And they found a high school ring engraved with initials JAS. Now, this is the point, though, where the police department in Chicago has assigned two teams to surveil Gacy. Four officers are on his tail at all times. Phone calls, watching him wherever he goes. He starts to get really freaked out about it. And they receive a phone call from a gentleman named Michael Rossi, who informed these investigators of a man named Gregory Godzik, who disappeared. And lo and behold, he was one of Gacy's employees. And another employee named Charles Hatula had been found drowned in an Illinois river earlier that year. And that same day, the high school ring was traced to a man named John Allen. I think it's Zick. Now, Michael Rossi, this guy, informant, comes back and gets interviewed a second time. This time he was a little bit more open, a little bit more cooperative, because he knew Gacy. And he informed detectives that in the summer of 1977, when Gacy asked, he spread 10 bags of lime in the crawl space of Gacy's house.
I'm still, like, baffled at how much space is in this crawl space that you're able to, like, dig up dirt, bury bodies, walk down there, spread lime. Like, I literally think of crawling in a crawl space.
And I do believe that, I mean, later in our discussion, and I think that we're going to show this and put a picture of it, because there's several photos of this crawl space when he declares where these bodies were buried.
Yeah.
It ain't that big.
That's so crazy.
But the officers, because of this second conversation that they had in 1977 with this informant, they decided then to get a second search warrant, knowing that he'd spread that many bags of lime around this crawl space. So the officers who are in surveillance obtain this second search warrant for his house, and they get into the home. And here's a couple of takeaways. We can go on and on about this, but here's a couple of takeaways. While flushing the toilet of Gacy's house, one officer noticed that he smelled something that could be of rotting corpses emanating from a heating duct when he flushed the toilet.
Casual. That could be rotting corpses, but I'm not sure.
Right? Yeah. Let me just double check.
It could be my kombucha or rotting corpses.
Yeah. Either or. Sure. We're not.
I should check my diet. Yeah. Okay.
Just check it out. And I mean, to anybody that we've ever spoken to, or anybody who has had a situation like this, y'all, like, that smell is apparently the worst thing that you could possibly. It's like unlike any other thing. I've heard. Right.
That's what I've heard.
Right.
Now, when they searched the house the first time, they failed to notice that. And then the second time that they came around, they also just made a distinction that the house was freezing cold, which didn't seem to make sense. But now, knowing what had happened, it makes sense. And after all of these men stepping forward who knew Gacy with these truly heinous stories of their personal experiences with him, it wasn't long before a confession happened. Now, Bonnie, the evening of December 20th, Gacy drove to his lawyer's office to attend a scheduled meeting. And on his arrival, he looked a little shitty, a little disheveled, and immediately asked for some booze, as you do.
Yeah.
Now, officers were there. The investigators were there with his lawyers. And they asked, after they gave him a drink, first of all, he got a drink first before he sits down with these investigators. Now, officers then ask him what he has to discuss with them. Gacy picks up a copy of the Daily Herald from the desk of the investigator, points to the front page article covering the disappearance of this Robert Peist, and said, quote, "This boy is dead. He's in a river," end quote.
Okay.
So,
how much alcohol did they give him, or he was just tired of running?
I mean, and there's the question. You know, when do you, I was watching a Dateline last night, I have to confess. And this guy said, after he confessed to the crime, he said, "Oh, it's been so long. It felt so good to just say that. Even though I know my life is ruined, it just felt really good to say that." So who knows what he was thinking. I mean, clearly he had been drinking. Right. And
where was this again? He was in an investigator's office.
Yes. Well,
called him in to talk to him.
He went to his
lawyer. And he's like, okay, give me a drink.
He went to
the lawyer. Lawyer. Thank you.
Yeah. I think he did fall asleep even in this initial investigation because of drinking, you know.
He did.
Anyway.
But for all intents and purposes, he let his lawyers know that there was something to talk about. His lawyers called the investigators and set up this meeting.
I see.
Now, in the midst of all this, he was like, number one, I'm going to need a drink or 22. And then, makes this whole confession thing happen that runs into the early hours of the following morning. Now, again, he had fallen asleep, passed out, you know, he's not in a good place right now. But he begins informing officers that he had been, quote, the judge, the jury, and the executioner of many, many people. And that he now wanted to be the same for himself. He said he buried most of his victims in his crawl space. He disposed of five other bodies in the Deplane River. Gacy dismissed his victims as, quote, male prostitutes, hustlers, and liars, to whom he gave the rope trick, adding he sometimes awoke to find dead strangled kids on his floor with their hands cuffed behind their back. He had buried their bodies in his crawl space as he believed they were his property. I know. Now, armed with yet another signed search warrant, police and evidence technicians, they drove to Gacy's home. Upon their arrival, officers found Gacy had unplugged his sump pump, flooding the crawl space with water. So to clear it, they simply replaced the plug. They waited for the water to drain. And after it had done so, the evidence technician, Daniel Genty, entered the 28 by 38 foot crawl space. Again, it ain't that large.
No.
But they crawled into the southwest area and began digging. And within minutes, the technician shouted to the investigators that they could charge Gacy with murder, adding, I think this place is full of kids.
Jeez.
Yeah, children. Like, kids. Children. I mean, it's kids. So horrible to me. Like, oh, they're liars and hustlers
Teens.
And prostitutes. I just can't. It's so awful.
And most
this
of
is truly,
them...
And, yeah.
I was just going to say, most of them, by the way, are the kids that Gacy was like... Do you want a job?
Yeah.
Like, I could give you a job. Like, I pay well. Like, and again, what do we notice most about these mofos parading around town is that, like, people think that they're good people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fuck? All right.
Well, yeah, that's how they get away with things for so long. So many serial killers don't look like serial killers.
Oh, my God, though. Like, upstanding
members
of community.
You think you can trust them.
And you can go, listeners, dear listeners, you can go to the Wikipedia page about him and read everything in more detail. We left certain things out, of course, and some of it are the details of the torture and the killings. It's just, you know, we're weighing what to keep in and not. You're like, okay, that's...
It's so much information. But you can also see a list of all of the victims. It is such an enormous amount of information and such an enormous amount of killings that this one person did.
Yeah.
And again, they're kids.
That big of a time period, right?
Nope.
It wasn't like 10 years.
Yeah.
It was a couple, right?
Certain things when you, I don't know, certain things, everyone has their triggers. I found this really hard to read. It was really, it's just horrifying.
And when you know it's kids, that's the worst part.
Yeah. 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 So Gacy was brought to trial on February 6th, 1980, charged with 33 murders. He was tried in Cook County, Illinois, before Judge Louis Carrippo. The jury was selected from Rockford because of significant press coverage in Cook County. At the request of his defense counsel, Gacy spent over 300 hours with doctors at the Menard Correctional Center in Chester in the year before his trial. He underwent a variety of psychological tests before a panel of psychiatrists to determine whether he was mentally competent to stand trial. Gacy attempted to convince the doctors that he suffered from a multiple personality disorder. He claimed to have four personalities: the hardworking, civic-minded contractor, the clown, the active politician, and a policeman called Jack Hanley, whom he referred to as Bad Jack.
Oh, God.
I hate him so much.
The actual devunk.
This Bad Jack.
Bad Jack.
Mm-hmm. I can't believe a clown is one of the personalities. Not like a job I used to do. Like, no, like, I am a clown. Part of me is. Sir, enough.
Sir.
Yeah. We'll post a picture of him as the clown. It's
awful. It's awful.
No. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Bonnie, don't look at it. Bonnie is scared.
All right. When Gacy had confessed to police, he claimed to be relaying the crimes of Jack, who detested homosexuality and who viewed male prostitutes as, quote, weak, stupid, and degraded scum, end quote.
I wanted to add that when he says, like, this guy Jack, right? Could Jack be like his version of his father? You know what I mean? Like,
Clearly, he was targeting these kids that were the age that he used to get beat up by his dad for seeming gay,
right?
Etc. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly, he's acting out his self hatred on these kids.
I just wanted to talk with my experts. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's your trigger right there. There's your trigger. So, his lawyers opted to have Gacy plead not guilty by reason of insanity to the charges against him. Presenting Gacy as a Jekyll and Hyde character, the defense produced several psychiatric experts who had examined Gacy. Three psychiatric experts at Gacy's trial testified they found him to be a paranoid schizophrenic with a multiple personality disorder. The prosecutors presented the case that Gacy was sane and in full control of his actions. To support this contention, they produced several witnesses to testify to the premeditation of Gacy's actions and the efforts he took to escape detection. Bonnie is giving us a
yes, because she's an expert, y'all. Don't question Bonnie.
Nodding, yeah. Absolutely. All right, I just want to, I don't know, this is, some of these victims were brave enough to testify, and we're going to talk about that right here. God bless them. Jeffrey Rignall testified on behalf of the prosecution on February 21st. Recounting his ordeal, Rignall wept repeatedly while describing Gacy's torture of him in March 1978. On February 29th, Donald Voorhees, whom Gacy sexually assaulted in 1967, testified to his ordeal at Gacy's hands and his subsequent attempts to dissuade him from testifying by paying another youth to spray mace in his face and beat him.
Voorhees
felt unable to testify, but did briefly attempted to do so before being asked to step down. And Robert Donnelly testified the week after Voorhees, recounting his ordeal at Gacy's hands in December 1977. Donnelly was visibly distressed as he recalled the abuse he endured and came close to breaking down several times. Yes. As Donnelly testified, Gacy, this motherfucker, repeatedly laughed at him. But Donnelly, God bless him, he finished his testimony. So
thank
what
God
a hero.
For him. Thank God. Right? For him.
I literally just got chills of disgust.
Yep.
Just disgusting. During the fifth week of the trial, Gacy wrote a personal letter to Judge Garippo requesting a mistrial for a number of reasons, including that he did not approve of his lawyer's insanity plea, that his lawyers had not allowed him to take the witness stand as he had wanted to do, that his defense had not called enough medical witnesses, and that the police were lying with regard to verbal statements he had purportedly made to detectives after his arrest, and that, in any event, the statements were, quote, self-serving for use by the prosecution. And it was denied. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you murdered 33 people at least and then assaulted many others. You're not going to be like, oh, mistrial, let him go. You're insane. That's more evidence of your insanity.
Absolutely. And you know what? He is clinically very, I would say clinically insane in many ways.
He's a psychopath.
But you know what? It doesn't change the fact. He's absolutely a psychopath, but it doesn't change the fact that he was competent enough to stand trial.
Yes.
I mean, it's true he was. He knew exactly what he was doing. Premeditation is 100%, like 100p, as the kids say, in this. And so that is what's so effing gross about all of this.
What's, to me, dicey when people are like, well, he was insane. It's like, yeah, but there's a difference between, like,
legally,
I didn't know what was happening and, like, something, you know, like if you have a multiple personality and they're like, but there's a part of me that is saying, like, put me in an institution rather than death row. Like, there's a big difference because psychopaths, you're crazy. You're insane.
And also,
there's something off in your brain, but you're aware of what you're doing you're murdering people.
Right. Well, and being competent to stand trial is different than the insanity defense. So one of them, the insanity defense is what was your state of mind at the time the crime was committed, and the competence to the trial is where you are at the time of the trial, right?
Right.
And when we're saying insane, correct me if I'm wrong, Bonnie, you're not saying that he wasn't aware of his actions at the time of the crime.
Absolutely not. He was very aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, I just want to say this. Defense attorneys, do not usually ever put their client
people on the stand.
They never do it because there's too much to lose. There's too much at stake. So of course they were not. Of course they weren't going to put him on the stand.
No.
But again, I love that as a little plea of his to be like, can I please have a mistrial? They would not put me on the stand. But really it's like, bro, you don't want to be on the stand because you're going to get decimated. Which brings me to the fact that the jury had deliberated for less than 2 hours. And we all know what that means. They found him guilty of 33 charges of murder, all 33, and he was found guilty of sexual assault and taking indecent liberties with a child. Both convictions in reference to Robert Peist, who we discussed as the one victim who brought all of this to light. Thank goodness for his family, who said that he couldn't possibly have run away from home and that reported him as a missing person because he is the one that brought all of this to light. So now at this time, his conviction for 33 murders was the most for which any person in United States history had been convicted. Now, in the sentencing phase of this trial, the jury deliberated for a little bit more than 2 hours before sentencing Gacy to death for each murder committed after the Illinois statute on capital punishment came into effect in June of 1977, and his execution was set for June 2nd of 1980. Now, upon being sentenced, Gacy was transferred immediately to the Menard Correctional Center, where he remained incarcerated on death row for over 14 years. And after his incarceration, he read numerous law books, he filed voluminous motions and appeals, although he did not prevail, thank God, in any
thank
of
God.
Them. And on the morning of May 9th of 1994, Gacy was transferred from the Menard Correctional Center to Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill to be executed. And according to published reports, Gacy was a diagnosed, thank you, Bonnie, psychopath who did not express any remorse for his crimes. Even in his final statement to his lawyer before his execution was that killing him would not compensate for the loss of others and that the state was murdering him. And his final spoken words were reported to be, quote, kiss my ass.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that special? He seems fun and with it. And after Gacy's death was confirmed at 12:58 a.m., on May 10th, 1994, and killers, you can go and read this on the Wikipedia page. It was death by lethal injection. There were a couple things that went wrong, and they had to sort of do it a couple of times in order for it to actually go through. But he was confirmed to be passed at 12:58 a.m. on May 10th, 1994, and his brain was removed and is now in the possession of a woman named Helen Morrison, a witness for the defense at Gacy's trial. She had interviewed Gacy and several other serial killers in an attempt to isolate common personality traits of violent sociopaths. So I'm sure that she was there to give reasons as to why he could possibly have done all of these things, because his brain was not functioning. As Jen, you have told us in the past, the brain does not look the same. Their brain does not look the same. And now she is in possession of his brain, and I want to swat her. And that's our story of John Wayne Gacy. But this story is so complex.
Yikes.
Bonnie, I want to know everything that you think about it. I really do.
I mean,
it's a lot to digest. So, you know.
It's horrifying. What's hard for me about so many of these horrible murderers and people that assault is, like, I don't know, the defense of, well, I was abused or I had these things. And it's like, do you know how many people are abused and made victims and conquer it and don't, I don't know, take it out on other people and don't become insane murderers? And it also just, like, makes me revere people that have been through similar things and are strong and fight for people that went through things like them, and rather than become an insane person. And it's just, it's so difficult to be like, well, he went through these things. And it's like, no, it's not an excuse, because people go through so many things too. Like, he was a psychopath. I would be curious to know, did he have tendencies before abuse? Like, was his father also a psychopath? You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of stuff that fascinates me beyond, like, the trigger of abuse. Like, well, what was there already?
Oh, yeah.
Because,
I guess we do talk all the time, like, at least I've spoken about this several times, of repeating cycles, familial cycles that exist in families. So his father was an alcoholic. Obviously, he liked to drink a lot. Obviously, that's what he asked for upon being interrogated, before he confessed. All of these things are at play. And you kind of wonder, like, well, what happened to his father when he was a child, which brought him to the fact that he was so homophobic, or that he was so, that he hated his own son.
Right. And as we've all, and as we've also discussed, and I know I've said it before on another episode, the best explanation experts have come up with where one shoe does not fit all is that it is a combination of biological, environmental, psychological, and developmental reasons. And you can have siblings in the same family who suffered the same abuse, and one becomes John Wayne Gacy and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
But to your point, Bonnie, I mean, I'm with you, and I'm sure Jess is too, but, you know, it is horrifying what happened to him, but Effie, we all got pain. It's like, you know, come on.
Yeah.
We all, you know, we all got pain.
Yeah.
And it's no excuse to do that.
Yeah.
No excuse. No.
No effing way. And like, it's again, it's what you choose to do with it. It's the therapies that people choose to get. It's the people who decide they want to break cycles. It's the, you know, this is hard work. It's hard effing work to do. And I understand that 2021 is very different than 1968, but at the end of the day, this is heinous. This is one of the worst crimes that we have discussed. And I have to say, Bonnie, I'm so thankful and grateful that you are our expert who came on today to discuss this crime with us, because, like, you got some good insights, Diva. Like, you got some really good insights. And also, like, you understand the world of true crime. And and half of this shit is unsurprising when you think about it at the end of the day. Like, Bonnie, you were like, why did you decide to kill this many people when you could have worked on yourself, bro?
You know?
But
was he an only child?
He was not. He had two sisters. He was the only son.
Yes.
But I'm sure that that made it very difficult when it came to a father who was a POS.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
Because the girls didn't get the brunt of that either. And even though mom seemed to be on his side, in the times being what they were.
Yeah.
Dad had the hold of the entire family. And that's...
Well, yeah. And you do wonder, you know, what would have happened to him if he'd had, you know, if that hadn't happened with his father? What would have happened if he had a healthy love and acceptance of his sexuality?
Yeah.
You know, and was it, you know, who knows? But we'll never know. But honestly, this was a long one. We cannot thank you enough, Bonnie, for dining in with us, as Jess said. We love you so much. Like, and you asked great questions.
Bonnie, girl, I have to tell you, you are like in it to win it, and I'm really fucking happy that you came on and gave us an hour plus of your time, because this is also one of the fucking worst ones that we've discussed.
The reviving.
Yeah. Oh.
What did I watch? God, it was on HBO. Patton Oswalt's wife.
Oh, yes.
Michelle McNamara, I guess.
Michelle McNamara, I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Mm-hmm. That... I watched, and I think that was such a well done series because her voice, and she was such a character. And then you know that she's going to die. Like, you know history, you know what happened. But when I was such a wreck, like, because she had been such a present voice, literally, throughout. They made that series so well. But I was sitting and I had, like, the door open, and the thermostat to the house is, like, right outside of my bedroom door. And I had my door open, and my stepdad had come in to change it at one point, but I had the door open, I'm watching the thing, and I thought I felt someone going to the thermostat, but what I felt was him leaving the thermostat. So I turned, waiting to watch someone walk away from it, and they never did. And you know that you would wake up and someone would be standing naked, and I couldn't sleep for days. Like, that one really fucked me up on top of that happening, and then I was like, oh no. But just the torture of, like, what's terrifying to me is what's going on in their brain to psychologically torture a victim before murdering them. Mm. And that, like, reviving someone to torture them more and to continuously do that before you kill them, what is going on in your head to do that?
And the worst part about it is, if you're telling me after the fact that you have four different personalities, and then you're going to say that something happened from these personalities and that's why this happened and that's why I did it, but you kept doing it over and over again, which means that somehow you have decided in your head that it was okay. Somehow you've been like, all right, and I'm going to have to do it again because there's an insatiable thing inside of me that needs to be fulfilled.
You hired someone to put lime on the bodies that are in your crawl space. You said 26?
Yes, 26. 26. And also
keeping bodies under your bed before you bury them.
And also, I do want to say this back on the record for Bonnie to hear this and for all of our killers to hear this, is that now subsequently the DNA has been, you know, revived and in the 70s, DNA testing was not what it is now. There were no databases. Yeah. There was nothing. So all the victims that they could not identify at the time, like they couldn't give a name to the body of the victim because they were so decomposed.
They can now.
They were able to, as recent as 2017, they were able to put names to the victims, which I think is something that's really important to know now.
Wow.
Because they could only identify them based on dental records back then because the bodies were so decomposed. Due to the lime and due to the fact that he had, well, quote, embalmed them to whatever effect that he did, they were really badly decomposed. And, you know, that, thank God for DNA being what it is now, that they didn't have back then. And now they're still able to go back and identify these victims, which thank God for their families who have been likely wondering for all of these years what happened, to have like maybe a little bit of peace of mind. I can't even say that because it doesn't even, you know, hold up to.
Can you imagine so many years later discovering not only is your child or your brother or whatever dead, that they went through insane torture and you learn that like 30 years later?
And I think that's always the scariest thing at the end of the day, is like to have to know what happened to somebody, especially if you know them personally, is really the worst part about this kind of thing. Only in my opinion.
Did he ever say what was there like? A reason why he kept some bodies close and like the ones he put in the river? Like, was there any like explanation of who he chose to very intimately keep?
To my knowledge, there was no rhyme or reason. I'm sure that maybe it was, you know, where they were at the time. Maybe they had been in his car. Maybe they were difficult to handle. Who knows? And I'm guessing this, Jen, maybe I'm wrong here. I'm guessing that the victims who were killed outside of the home, he never lured into the home to begin with. So I'm guessing it was maybe like at a job site, at a parking lot, met somewhere, you know, that kind of thing. But again, they're all young men. It's so hard to like understand somebody's brain.
Well, and also to your point, there's been lots of books on this. And so maybe one of our readers has the answer to that question. You know, we love when you do give us the answer. So if you heard Bonnie's question and you know the answer of why some of them were put in the river and it's, you know, different, or you have something to add to it, go ahead and let us know.
Please. Right? Like, please.
Please.
But dearest Bonnie, we should get out of here. We love you. You are a fucking genius and I love you.
I love you. I love you both.
I love you back so, so much. And it makes me, it's a tease to see you. Like, it would be really nice to see you in person. And I can't wait. Now I know why they call it the Roaring Twenties, you guys. You know, after the first pandemic, you know, and everyone just was like, I cannot wait to go to a loud, crowded restaurant and a bar and just see y'all. I cannot wait.
And not like this, like to actually have not a mask on and to be like, sis, let's hug. Let's get some germs. But good ones.
You know, I like a nice little quiet nook. And now I'm like, give me the loudest place with lots of bodies bumping into me. And I can't wait. Thanks, Bonnie.
Thanks, gals. Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Aww.
Bonnie, we love her.
We love her. What a gem. What a gemstone in the rough. We also love you, crime fam. Thank you so much for listening and to this insane episode. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get your exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.